Your Focus with Ciara Plunkett.
You're welcome on in to Friday's edition of Kildare Focus. In just a moment, we'll be talking about government's failure to hold test spectator events. We'll hear from Jen Hogan. She's a journalist, author even, and broadcaster. She's conducted a really interesting poll on her social media channels, and she's asking people whether or not they would allow a teenage boy as opposed to a teenage girl to babysit their children. The results are very, very interesting. Did you ever want to know how to age smarter? Well, Dr. Michael Cook may have the answer. He's a lecturer in applied psychology at Maynooth University. As you've been hearing across our news bulletins today, the ESRI says tax increases in the order of 5 billion euro may be needed in the coming years. I'll be discussing that with economist and ESRI research officer Barrett Rowntree. We'll be talking all things Leaving Cert and the fear of contracting COVID prior to the written exams with Brian Mooney, managing editor at Education Matters. As always, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with your comments, your requests, your dedications by text or WhatsApp to 0833 97 97 97. You can drop us an email to studio@kfmradio.com, or you can tweet us at KFM Radio. Now, we've been hearing about it for several weeks, that there are proposals to stage test spectator events. Off the top of my head, I think that Leinster Rugby was one of the organisations that proposed trialling a spectator event sometime in June, and was waiting to hear back from government on whether or not it could proceed with that. Nonetheless, in the interim, the Health Minister, Stephen Donnelly, has said that there could be a number of spectators at the All-Ireland Hurling Final, which isn't until August. I'm joined on the line to discuss this by Professor Liam Fanning, Professor at Immunology, Immunovirology and Deputy Head of the Department of Medicine at UCC. Liam, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you.
The I would imagine the logistics of creating and then staging and successfully pulling off a test spectator event are challenging, but we do have a template of sorts. I know the UK is having spectators at events. Other parts of the world are holding events where spectators are attending. Not so much here.
Correct. We do have a template, and I suppose what we've learned a lot from this pandemic is that we look around the globe and we see those other countries that have done things before us, and how we can maybe adapt them to Irish society and culture. And the Israelis, in particular, as you will be aware, Ciara, have led the world in this. And when they kind of got to about an 80% of the population vaccinated, they actually dropped masks for large outdoor gatherings and actually for regular social engagement. So I suppose That's one aspect of the evidence that supports, that once we get a particular percentage of the population vaccinated, we can actually drop some of the NPIs, as they're called, non-pharmaceutical interventions for the management of COVID-19 in Ireland. The second is the latest data that was published in the UK on their holding of mass events without masks and social distancing. And, the inference from that data is that it can be as safe at an outdoor event as going to a restaurant or shopping centre. And the CDC, their director, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, has said, has defended her decision to kind of tell people that who are fully vaccinated that they can go without masks. And that's what she has said, which I thought was phrased nicely. We're asking people to be honest with themselves. And if they're vaccinated, then they don't need to wear a mask and they're safe. And if they're not vaccinated, well, they do need to wear a mask because they don't have that protection provided by the vaccine. And, for these large events that are coming our way in June, July, and hopefully maybe our Ireland finals in September, we will have many more of the population vaccinated. If the government hits its target of 82% by the end of June, having at least one shot, whether it's two shots or maybe even fully vaccinated if it's the J&J one shot, then by the end of July, we're in a very good position as a population to have very large numbers of the population vaccinated and immune, and therefore large events can be supported by antigen testing. People have been honest with themselves in regard to am I at risk? Have I been in contact with somebody who's waiting for a test? At that stage, there should be less people who are unvaccinated, and there should be less of COVID-19 in the country. We've seen the numbers come down slowly, and we're now in the bottom tier of countries for the number per 100,000 across Europe. So there's lots of positives to think that we can actually further reduce the non-pharmaceutical interventions that have been, and one of them would be actually attendance of crowds at large sporting events and maybe concerts and, you know, social events such as discos and whatever else you're having yourself. You know what I mean? That kind of way.
Now, speaking of case numbers, Neffet has just confirmed 524 new cases of COVID-19. That is under reservation, if you will, if I can steal a phrase from the Central Statistics Office, because of the impact on a wide variety of HSE systems arising from last Friday's cyber attack. But in terms, Liam, of what appears to be a government reluctance to stage any kind of test events, given the wealth of templates of signposts internationally of what has worked, of what hasn't worked. Do you have any sense as to why they seem to have been reluctant to do so? Is the rate of the vaccination rollout a factor, would you imagine?
I'm perplexed as to why there hasn't been, you know, a take-up of the IRFU or the sporting organisations to trial this scenario. We're going to have to dip our toe in the water with this sometime. And now is actually a very good time. You know, we have a certain amount of vaccinated. We'll have more in June and do it again then in June and look at the data. And, you know, I think the data will support what's been found in the UK and in Israel, that if carefully managed, that these events are actually safe.
And we have seen already huge events in Ireland which were expected to be staged next September, most notably among them the National Ploughing Championships. And I spoke to its managing director, Anna Mae McHugh, this day last week on the programme on their announcement of the fact that it would not be proceeding. And a keynote factor in that decision-making was quite rationally the fact that they have no roadmap from government to stage what is an outdoor event. Yes, it's the largest agriculture-related outdoor event in Europe, but it is an outdoor event where they have total control over the number of people that can enter or exit the premises at any given time.
Yeah, I suppose some of the concerns there may have been how people are actually going to get to it. But bear in mind, again in September, the caveats that applied to group meetings in March of this year and we'll say certainly December last year won't necessarily apply in September because we will have so much of the population vaccinated. Now I realise that Anna Mae will have, you know, there's too much time of lead-in time required.
Yeah, I mean, an event of that magnitude, it must take a year or more to put together.
I imagine so, and you know, the uncertainty, we'll say, with a couple of months before, so maybe they needed to organise this in February, March, at the latest, was just too uncertain a time frame where we would be in September. But, you know, I think we're beginning to see far much more light at the end of the tunnel. And we will be soon able to organise these kind of events. And I think, you know, that the Ploughing Championship, you know, it will definitely be going ahead in 2022. I can't see, you know, COVID-19 in 2022 will be, hopefully, a virus that has faded so much into the background that we pay no heed to the daily numbers, and the very few individuals that are picking up this have either chosen not to be to get vaccinated, or are those few individuals who are vaccinated have managed to pick up the infection again. But bear in mind, those individuals who are vaccinated, if they do happen to pick up this infection, you know, they're likely to have asymptomatic disease. They're likely not to require hospitalization, or they're likely to be able to manage it, and we will have booster shots. So if you like, the population of Ireland is going to get a boost in from probably about October to maybe March or April next year with another dose of the of these mRNA vaccines. I imagine that most of the boosters will be mRNA vaccines because we have had wonderful data coming out of the early clinical trials showing using mixing of these vaccines, so AstraZeneca first and the mRNA vaccine second, and what the early data suggests that there's a very robust immune response. If you've had AstraZeneca first and then get a booster shot, just one shot of the mRNA vaccine. So I think the landscape is going to change radically over the next couple of months with the vaccines that we have and then the boosters, such that, you know, large outdoor events will be very much a feature of our social life again.
Well, Professor Liam Fanning, on that positive note, a professor in immunovirology and deputy head of the Department of Medicine at UCC, thank you indeed for joining us. I want to flesh out an item we brought to you first in our 2 o'clock news headlines. And NASCAR, the station, have been in touch with us within the last hour to say that they have been inundated with phone calls from members of the public ringing in reporting fraudulent and scam phone calls. The numbers usually, but not always, are beginning with 083. There is an automated voice recording informing the person that they have committed an offence, and if the person presses 1, they are put through to a person who tries to entice information from them. Naois Gardaí tell us that they wish to inform the public to be vigilant of these phone calls and not to give out any information over the phone to these scammers. Very sage advice there from Gardaí at Naois. We're bringing you Jen Hogan, journalist, author and broadcaster of Mamatude.com, because she has posed a very, very interesting question on social media, and some of the responses are fairly choice. Jen, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thanks, Claire. Thanks for having me.
Now, you asked, your poll is still running if anybody wants to engage with it on Twitter. It's at Jen Hogan Journo. And the question is and arising from an experience in many conversations, honestly, would you hire a teenage boy to babysit or help with childcare? Why did you ask it in the first place?
I suppose, I mean, I've had, like I said, there's been between personal experience of perhaps even my boys being passed over. I have 7 children, so my older children have huge, huge experience with younger children. And my daughter, who's my eldest, was always in huge demand as a babysitter, always, because, you know, she could kind of take care of any age in terms of having, she'd had the experience of it. She was used to taking care of lots of children at once. And so I figured it made sense that those 1 and 2 down from her who only had 1 or 2 less siblings would also be hugely in demand. And I remember it actually started, my curiosity around this really started last year when my eldest son was coming out on holidays, and I was chatting, saying, I think I'll try and see a bit like his sister, if he can get some work helping parents with childcare and babysitting, you know, over the summer, you know, encourage him maybe to put a couple of notes indoors. And a mother turned to me and said, oh no one's going to hire a teen boy. And it got me thinking, really? And then there was a conversations going on there a little while ago, again within parent WhatsApp groups, just having the general chat, and people are looking for child minders or help again over the summer, and the very specific request is that they are teen girls. So it's not teen boys that people are looking for.
Or the assumption is that the only people who will go forward for those roles and or be hired will be teenage girls.
The presumption is, yeah, but the thing is, you may forget about it if you're a boy, because if you are a boy who is happy to do that and would like to do that and is capable of doing that, and there's no reason that a teen boy would be any less capable than a girl, you know, I know it obviously depends on the teenager, and that came up a lot in response to the poll, which at least was some kind of comfort that it depends on the teenager, their experience, their maturity and things like that. And that's going to be the same for any of us who recruit the services of a babysitter or a childminder. How capable are they? But there were an awful lot of messages that came to me, both publicly, it was commented publicly on the social media, but also privately, saying that they just didn't, it just was a no. There were some parents who said they were disappointed in themselves. They never thought about it until I asked the question, and then they said, it's actually no. My answer is no, and I'm really disappointed that I would say no, but I think no. There were some who said, no, they just don't believe boys are as capable as girls. And then there was the one that I suppose upset me the most, but at the same time, I did appreciate people being honest. I did ask them to be honest. But these beliefs that teenage boys are potential predators, and there was that concern that therefore they're not suitable childminders because you wouldn't want to leave them with a child. It was also addressed the whole idea of maybe if children were older, but not if they needed help around potty training or anything like that.
And I mean, that is unbelievable. The people that responded, either DM'd or tweeted you about this, have cast an entire gender under a pall of suspicion with absolutely no evidence whatsoever. And leaving that aside, the assumption that there is or could be some kind of predatory element there. They don't know that, but they've already decided that. Mm-hmm. Then there's the secondary and arguably equally as damaging on a long-term basis assumption of a lack of capability, because we already have that trope, oh, daddy's babysitting his children, isn't he great? Daddy can't help with the newborn because he hasn't a clue what he's doing. If it's a first baby, neither does mammy.
Absolutely. I mean, the first time I ever held a child was when my own baby was when my own baby, first baby was born. And that's exactly it. When it's a new baby, everybody's learning. It's a learning experience for everybody. But like, if we are to be a feminist society and interpret feminism in its true meaning, which is equality and respect for all, then that has to work both ways. And that means we cannot presume that men cannot do the jobs that are traditionally associated with women. And for women also to move on and to be able to, you know, to partake in society as they'd like, whether that, and if that involves going out to work outside the home, then it needs to be a household where everybody is pulling their weight and everybody is capable of pulling their weight. But again, if you look at the broader thing and you look at the WhatsApp groups, you look at the organisation around Children's When We're Allowed outside of COVID times, obviously the restrictions, and we're talking play dates and stuff. These things are always organised amongst mums. There's been so many times where you'll get that message, oh, I can't do today because I'm working at whatever time and sure himself wouldn't be able to manage. Why wouldn't he be able to manage?
Because you have decided that he can't manage, and he has shown no inclination to be able to manage because he's already been told he can't do it.
He can't do it, and we are doing this to our teen boys now. This is what we're telling them. You're not capable. This is not for you. So we have this kind of total imbalance where we're telling girls, you can be anything, you can do anything, achieve anything you want, and quite rightly so. But we're telling boys, you can't do this, you can't do that, you can't manage things like childcare, like taking care of somebody younger, like meeting the needs of a younger person. Anything domestic or child based is not the caring professions. Even they're never held up as goals that boys should aspire towards, or careers that boys should look at. These are very much female careers, but not necessarily through just choice, but because we tell boys they can't do those things. We're not equally rearing our children to tell them that they can achieve or be whoever they want to be. Boys, maybe societal expectations of boys can be pretty toxic, and they're damaging not only to boys but to girls too, and to women and men too as we go forward.
And what is, I suppose, as representative as anything else connected with this question, is that it's so riven with gender stereotyping that you would never pose it about girls.
No, that's exactly it. And somebody commented on the poll and said, oh, it's a very interesting question. I said, yes, and a question I'd never ask about girls. And that's exactly it. The fact that we have a situation where at one stage over 40% of people have said absolutely no way would they have recruit the services of a boy as either to help them with childcare or as a babysitter, but we would never ask that of girls. We would absolutely never ask, is this acceptable? And if that question was to go out about something else, well, would you have a girl do something else that might be traditionally associated with a boy, there'd be outrage and uproar. And if people were saying no, there would be outrage and uproar. But we're tolerating this, and we're accepting this sort of negative stereotype and ring fencing and presumptions and preconceived ideas for our teen boys, and ultimately who will be our men. You know, we are accepting this for them, and we wouldn't the other way around. And not accepting it the other way around is what we should be aspiring towards.
Jen Hogan, journalist, author, broadcaster of Mamatude.com. Thank you indeed for joining us. And as I said, that poll is still running on Jen's Twitter page at present. 60% of people say they would allow a teenage boy to babysit or assist with childcare. 40% say no. What do you think? Is this an issue for you? Would you not cast it a thought? Or is it a hard no for you? Text or WhatsApp 0833 97 97 97. Coming up after the break, how to age smarter and tax hikes. I suppose we all of us hope to grow old and live to a ripe age, but we want to do that in as vibrant and as vital a way as we possibly can. To discuss how to age smarter and healthier, joined on the line by Dr. Michael Cook. He's a lecturer in applied psychology at Maynooth University. Michael, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you, Ciara.
What do you mean when you say age smarter and healthier?
Yeah, so as we're all aware, we're an aging population around Europe, and that brings with it a range of problems that we're becoming more and more familiar with, especially as we're living longer on average, but we're also dealing with more health-related issues. There's also a broader range of challenges that society brings, including technology and the fact that we're living more distributed lives, even globalized lives. We've, you know, every family has got relatives around the world as well. So what healthy or smart aging means is about preparing not only older people of today, but ourselves who are part of the aging population for that time in our life when we will, you know, have greater dependencies from each other, from, you know, the health services, the health and social care services, and from, you know, society in general.
I would imagine that the first step in that would be looking after yourself.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. So we're trying to work towards a situation where younger people of today are aware of what they need to do in terms of living healthily while we're relatively young, so we can be more prepared for you know, more health, a better quality of life when we get older. And part of that is to do with, you know, minding our health and our diet and exercise as well, but also being aware of the resources that might be available to us now and in the future, including technology, that might allow us to, you know, be more independent. For example, being less dependent on institutional care when we get older, or the health service, and being able to, you know, take better care of ourselves at home.
I would imagine that making an active and conscious decision to remain as socially connected as is feasible, as is possible, and as you wish, it would be a key factor to the quality of life, because loneliness, as we know, does kill.
Absolutely, and we know that loneliness has an impact on our physical health as well. So, you know, we're people of a certain, even my age, so I'm in my 40s now, but we're very much immersed in our lives, every aspect of our lives, in terms of technology and social media and connectedness. And that's part of the solution, but that also brings challenges. So what we're trying to do at Maynooth University with the SHAPES project is try to understand what is it that forms the fabric of our lives, of our social lives, our cultural lives, our, you know, our work lives, and every aspect of living that we engage in. And part of the solution for aging smartly and healthily is becoming more literate when it comes to not just social media, but also the technologies that can afford us better health care at home, and you know, bring about that sort of independence that that we're going to rely on later.
That suggests to me that remaining curious for your entire life is a key factor in aging well.
Yes, I would say so, and I think that older people, and you know, that spans a very very wide age range.
Yeah, and to a degree is up to your own definition. Some people may define themselves as older when they're 60, and some people may never do so.
Absolutely, but it is key to maintain a sense of curiosity and a sense of motivated interest in how we should be living our lives. And independence doesn't just mean you know, remaining out of institutional care, but it's also being involved actively in the nature of your care and having a say in, for example, the governance of healthcare and the governance of the solutions that that might be down on the pipeline down the line that might impact our lives later. So taking an active interest in healthcare and the options available to us, that's an important part of it as well.
Tell us a little about the scale of the SHAPES project. It's fairly vast, 36 partners, 14 countries.
That's right, yeah. And there's approximately around 200 people involved in that project around Europe. And in Ireland, we are, in Maynooth University, we're leading that project. And we're going to be working with approximately 2,000 aging people around Europe in a variety of different contexts. Some of them at home, some of them currently in institutional care, in nursing homes, some of them living relatively independently, but we're also looking at the potential role that technology assistance can bring to help them to remain at home and be independent. But it's not just about independence, it's also about quality of life in general, and that social connectedness that you mentioned.
Well, Dr. Michael Cook, sorry for you were saying, Michael?
That's basically it. So what we're looking to do is to take a European-wide solution. So it's not just a regional problem. There's a great diversity around Europe, but we're looking for a European solution that can facilitate that diversity around Europe and keep people connected.
Well, Dr. Michael Cook, lecturer in applied psychology at Maynooth University and one of the key Maynooth University participants in the Pan-European SHAPES project, thank you indeed for joining us. Tax increases of anywhere up to €5 billion might be needed over the forthcoming years for a variety of reasons. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line by Barra Rowantree. He's a Research Officer at the ESRI. He's also an economist and a co-author of this latest report. Barra, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thanks for having me on.
Delighted to do so. $5 billion makes for a very grim reading, and it's a sum of money most of us can't conceive of.
Yeah, that's right. And I suppose, you know, what we've seen over the last few months with COVID is a big increase in government spending, and which was exactly the right thing to do, to kind of essentially put the economy on life support. And that's not really what the kind of the tax increases we're talking about being needed are really for. It's really in the longer run that we're talking about expanding the state in lots of new ways. There's kind of, you can hear people talking about reforming the healthcare system, and there's lots to talk about expanding welfare entitlements to groups who maybe you haven't had them. That being maybe a consequence of the pandemic and people realising that there were shortfalls in that. There's also an ageing population. So we know we're set to go from a country with very favourable demographics from the point of view of there's a high number of workers to non-workers, which allows us to kind of finance the public spending and transfers that the state carries out. But that's going to change over the next few years. And then on top of that, the existing taxes that we levy, the $5 billion figure refers to the Department of Finance. I think there's about $2 billion in corporation tax receipts, which are going to disappear because of international agreements on that. And there's also about $3.5 billion a year levied in motor taxes, which of course are linked to fossil fuels, and that's, and we think those are probably going to dissipate in the coming years. So that's really the kind of context for this, of why we're saying that we need to maybe start looking at how we might want to pay for some of the public services that are being discussed, unless we want to roll back others.
Because that's a very complex bundle of needs there, and I would imagine that they cannot really be adequately served by the tax system as it's currently constituted.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, so if you kind of think about, you know, that sum of money disappearing from taxes we already levy, and then big demands elsewhere in the system, and you know, you'll hear, and I'm sure lots of your listeners will often be in touch about some of the gaps in public services and spending that are there at the moment. So the point really is, you know, if we're going to address those gaps, that requires more spending. And yes, maybe there's some other elements of spending that can be rolled back, but that's not really what anyone's talking about at the moment. It's really about where is looks like there's going to be a larger state, and so how do we pay for that? And we just set out a bunch of options. We're not advocating or prescribing any, and ultimately, you know, this is something for us as a society to decide together through, you know, what governments we elect and what political parties want to do. So it's just about getting that conversation running, and probably helpfully away from a general election.
And some of the moves this or successive governments could make would include an increase in income tax, VAT, or the local property tax. Now, nobody has gone near the local property tax in about, 9 years? So it's ripe for review as it stands.
That's right. And I mean, the local property tax as it stands is levied on the property values that were estimated in 2013. So they're very out of date. And what that means is that, you know, people who've seen their property increase substantially aren't paying tax on that big increase. What you also have is that any new houses, owner-occupied houses that have been built since 2013, don't have local property tax levied at all. So there's kind of a bit of an equity there in terms of how that tax is levied. And it also doesn't really make sense to be levying it on 2013 values. So there's potential for more revenue to be raised from that, just even by updating the valuations and by bringing in those newly built properties into scope. But again, the sums that we're talking about wanting to spend more are going to require more than that. You know, you can raise quite a bit. You can raise hundreds of millions through the increases in local property tax. But really, if we're talking about raising billions, as which seems to be what, you know, people are talking about and wanting, then really it's hard to see how you can do that without increases in broad-based taxes on income and consumption. So income tax, USC, PRSI, or VAT.
Here's the difficulty that this or any other government will run into. Should they take on board absolutely every single word that's in this latest ESRI research, Barra, and say, we're going to run with this, this is fantastic, and you say, grand, off you go. The problem that they're going to run in is not a fiscal problem, it's not an arithmetic problem, it's not an economic one. It is an emotional problem, because I think that a vast majority of people perhaps wouldn't mind paying higher taxes in certain and limited circumstances or in certain and limited pockets of their fiscal lives if they felt they were getting value from it. And I think that most people, if they sat down and think about it, do not feel that they are obtaining value from the taxes they pay now, much less higher taxes in a variety of areas of their lives that they may pay in the future.
Yeah, I'm sure that's right. There's lots of areas of public services where we know there's gaps and we feel that aren't maybe catering to the needs we'd like. But again, what we're talking about here is increases in that. And so maybe there are some efficiencies to be made, but it's very hard to see how you could come up with the scope of increases that are being talked about through efficiencies. That just doesn't seem credible to I think me or I imagine most people. If we are talking about that, figure of billions rather than hundreds of millions. And so then it does come down to, well, okay, if we do want these services, and again, that's a question for people to discuss as well, is if we want these services, how do we want to spend them? No one really would like to, of course, pay for these things, but if we want these services, we're going to have to. And so then really the debate then is about how do we do that?
Is there a looming deadline as to when, Barra, governments should take a decision as to how to tackle this issue?
No, not at all. I mean, this is really a challenge, a medium to long run challenge. And we're very clear in saying in the report that the government shouldn't be looking at increasing income taxes as the economy recovers. That would be wrong to do. Mm. We don't want to withdraw support from the economy too early as we recover from the pandemic. And we don't want to increase taxes too early because people are just going to take time to get back to spending and employment to recover. So we shouldn't be doing it in the next, 3 to 5 years, that kind of timeline. This is more about the longer term issues and how do we fund those public services that we would like. So there's no need for urgency on that. But it would be helpful if there's going to be kind of a roadmap laid out for what way we want to go. And from that point of view, starting the conversation and starting thinking about these things now is more useful than waiting down the line when the spending is rising, we suddenly have to make a crunch decision. It's better to kind of get these discussions going and conversations going on this earlier rather than later.
Economist and research officer at the ESRI, Barra Rowantry, thank you indeed for joining us. Coming up after the break, we'll be talking leaving cert and fear of contracting COVID-19. Just want to remind you that NASCAR, the station, tell us that they have been inundated with people reporting fraud and scam phone calls. In the majority, but not exclusively, they're coming from mobile phone numbers with the prefix 083. And they are telling people in a pre-recorded message that they are suspected of or have been suspected of committing an offence, and they need to press 1, etc., etc., in order to get through to NASCAR, the station. Gardaí do not communicate with people in this way at all whatsoever. So be very, very wary of any phone calls that you're getting, because this isn't the only scam doing the rounds, of any phone calls that you're getting from numbers which are not known to you. And of course, if you're getting emails or texts unsolicited that look in any way suspicious or even look like they're from a party that you may engage with, your bank, etc., etc., if they're asking you for information, just don't give it. It's more than likely a scam. Now, the leaving cert looms, which, is a nerve-wracking enough time if you are among those that are sitting the written exams, but then we have the added COVID factor. I'm joined on the line to discuss this by Managing Editor at Education Matters, Brian Mooney. Brian, you're welcome to the programme.
Hi, Sarah. How are you?
I'm not too bad at all. Leaving cert students, were I one of them, I probably would be feeling a bit nervous because they're being urged to take extra caution in the run-up to the exams to help minimise the risk of COVID-19 outbreaks. Does that mean that they're effectively being advised to self-isolate?
Well, I wouldn't say fully self-isolate, but at the end of the day, as you know, there's a two-stage process here. They are all being assessed for assessed grades, whether they've applied for them or not. Then that gives the state a safety net. And the teachers over the next week or so will determine within each school, with the working in cooperation with their principal, what the school's estimate of the assessed grade for every single student is, or assessed percentage mark, to be absolutely accurate. And all of those will be different. Obviously, no two students can get the same mark. And when that is submitted to the State Exams Commission, they will then do the standardisation of those assessed grades based on previous year's patterns, the junior cert results of these particular students, and any other elements that are put into that algorithm that is now being developed. And then the state will finish that process, assess grades, and that will be the final mark for the student, unless, of course, they do the leaving cert itself and get a higher grade. Mm. Now, as you know, because of the loss of tuition time, papers have been readjusted, The papers have been made somewhat easier so that students who didn't have good digital connections, etc., will not lose out. And therefore, it is quite possible, and in fact probably probable, that many students who get to sit the written paper may get a higher grade in the written paper than they do in the standardized assessed grade paper. And if obviously they get COVID or are a close contact, or for some reason the school center had to be closed down for COVID reasons, then they wouldn't get to sit those papers, and they might then find that even though the assessed grade standardized for them, or they were happy enough with them, if the points go up considerably based on the fact that if the leaving certs are results are quite good based on easier papers, then they might lose out. So it is really important to students that they ensure that they don't in any way lead to a situation where they themselves can't sit the paper bluntly, or that their colleagues or their classmates can't do the same.
I have to be honest, I'm not particularly eager to do the Leaving Cert again, but you couldn't have paid me to do it last year or this year. Just the level of additional stress, no matter how well managed the system is, and on a school by school basis, I have no doubt that in many locations it's expertly managed, but all of this additional COVID related rigmarole, if you will, and I use that term with respect, just seems enormously stressful on teachers as well, because they're essentially double jobbing.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously the centres are being spread out. In fact, the same probably level of resources are probably being used to run the Leaving Cert this year as would have normally be used to run the entire Leaving Cert and Junior Cert together. And remember, there's a cohort of students who don't apply to the CEO any year, and they are perfectly happily going on to do further education programs. They're happy to go on and, you know, do apprenticeships or maybe go directly to employment. Most of those students effectively need to, you know, secure 5 or 6 passes in their Leaving Cert, and they're happy out with the assessed grades. So in fact, the numbers who are registered for the written papers are probably in and around the numbers who are actually hoping to get places through the CAO.
In terms then of minimising contacts for those that are sitting the traditional exam, what should that look like, Brian?
Well, I would just say, you know, you don't go out in groups in, you know, particularly in closed environments. You don't go indoors. You know, and if you are outdoors, you know, try and maintain the social distance. I know it's a pain, but the truth of the matter is all you need, I mean, I'm aware of schools where effectively there have been outbreaks among students where classes have had to be discontinued, and where students, you know, may be in a position where the school cannot offer them. And that's the reason that the State Exams Commission will have an assessed grade for everybody, whether you've applied for one or not, because effectively there will not be any, you know, whereas in the last number of years, Minister Joe McHugh put in a provision where students who had a family bereavement could sit a paper again in July. Yeah. All of that is gone this year. There is no sitting other than the one sitting of the paper. And if you're not in a position to attend the centre, or the school isn't in a position to be open on that day, then effectively you're not going to get to sit the paper.
Is that the right call, Brian?
Pardon?
Is that the right call in your view?
Well, it probably is, in the sense that you know, obviously they are going to facilitate somebody who has a bereavement in terms of the actual, as they've done in previous years, somebody would take you to the funeral, be with you at the time, and take you back to a centre and have the exam sat later in the day, you know, and that's all done very sensitively as it was in the past. But they're not going, they probably don't have the resources, given the amount of resources they're going to put in to try and run the exam safely. They're saying the exam will run once this year and that's it. And if you're there on the day, you're there. And other than that, you don't get to sit it. And I would say one thing to students. I'm hearing back, you know, if this is all anecdotal stuff.
Yeah.
But I was talking to a parent the other day who said to me that, you know, in her daughter's school, the girls are all determined to do the written paper. But some of the fellows are now saying, Asher, why would you bother? I'm telling you, if you're out there and you're a student, the students who went to the bother of sitting the Leaving Cert last November, and there was only 2,000 of them,
yeah,
right? Oh, nearly 40% of them got a higher grade, at least one higher grade, which gave them a higher offer on the CAO. And 600 of the really, really
top point places have gone to those 600 students who are going to start on programmes this coming September out of this year's quota of places, and they are going to do it on the basis that they went to the bother of at least sitting one paper, and some of them a number of papers in November, and they got the benefit. You know, it may be tempting in the month of June to say, ah, look, I won't bother going in for that paper, but you could really regret it if at the end of the day you're 5 or 10 points short for a course and your assessed grade is lower than you might have anticipated in terms of the grades that you achieve.
Well, Brian Mooney, Managing Editor at Education Matters, thank you indeed for joining us.